Hello, and welcome to the History of the Early Church. Episode 52, Sanguinary Edicts. On February 23rd, 303 AD, the senior Roman Emperor Diocletian and his Caesar Galerius looked out from the imperial palace in Nicomedia over to the large Christian church, which stood in the city. The Praetorian prefect Flaccinus, along with high military officers and treasury officials, broke down the doors of the church and proceeded to confiscate all its visible wealth. An image of the deity was sought after, and the Christian scriptures were seized and burned. All the church's utensils used for worship, whether gold, silver, or otherwise, were pillaged. After this, Galerius at great length advocated burning the sanctuary down, but Diocletian's cooler head prevailed. The Praetorian Guard then marched on the structure, their golden armor glinting in the sunlight. Arrayed in battle formation and armed with axes and other weapons, the Praetorians succeeded in razing the entire church to the ground within a matter of hours. The great persecution had begun. The following day, Diocletian's first edict of persecution was posted in the public forum of Nicomedia. It stipulated that all Christians of rank were to be stripped of their status and privileges, including exemption from torture. Christian imperial freedmen were now re-enslaved to the imperial estates. Christian assemblies were banned. All churches and homes where Christian books were kept were to be destroyed. All copies of the scriptures and liturgical books were to be consigned to the flames. Church property and wealth was to be confiscated to the imperial treasury. Anyone who pleaded in court as a plaintiff, civil or criminal, was required to offer public sacrifice, depriving Christians of any legal recourse if their neighbors committed crimes against them. With this last measure, Diocletian was inviting his fellow pagans to participate in the persecution. Shortly after the edict was posted, a hot-headed local Christian named Euethius entered the forum, tore down the law, and publicly mocked the emperors by stating, "These are the triumphs of Goths and Sarmatians." Euethius was immediately arrested, tortured, and burned alive. If Christians wanted to provoke him, Diocletian was ready to answer with the severest measures. Still, the senior Augustus stuck to his moderating principles, trying to avoid outright bloodshed if possible. His Caesar, on the other hand, was not satisfied with the first edict, desiring to go further. Galerius got his opportunity only a few days later. Towards the end of February 303, a mysterious fire broke out in the imperial palace and caused serious damage to the living quarters of the emperors. The cause of the fire remains officially unknown to this day. Lactantius states it was agents of Galerius who lit the fuse so the Caesar could blame the Christians and inflame Diocletian to take harsher measures. Rumor quickly spread that the Christians were responsible, and Diocletian embarked on a vicious inquisition of his household, using sacrifice as a test of loyalty. Many Christians in the domestic service of the emperor were rounded up, interrogated, tortured, and executed. On March 11th, the Christian eunuch Gorgonius, long distinguished for his loyal service to Diocletian, was tortured and executed by strangulation. The following day, another long-serving eunuch of the emperor's attained the crown of martyrdom, Dorotheus, possibly the same person as the Antiochian presbyter who Diocletian had once put in charge of the imperial purple dye factory in Tyre. Dorotheus was joined by several others who bore testimony for the Lord before giving up their lives. The most spectacular of these was an imperial chamberlain named Peter. The emperors had him brought out in public where he was stripped and whipped for his refusal to sacrifice. After enduring these tortures, the soldiers poured salt and vinegar on his exposed wounds. When this failed, the torturers turned to a far more grisly method. Peter was slowly roasted alive as he was rotated over a brazier. As Peter Lighthart puts it, the Roman soldiers were symbolically cannibalizing Peter. Even now, though, Peter still refused to sacrifice and finally gave up his life on March 12, 303. Despite all these executions, the culprits of the fire were never discovered. A couple days later, a second fire broke out in Nicomedia. Galerius left the city that very day, declaring the Christians would soon burn them all alive in revenge. Diocletian's rage was now unleashed. First, he forced both his wife Prisca and daughter Valeria to sacrifice. There are hints in the sources that the two empresses may have been sympathetic to Christianity, or even Christians themselves. If this was true, then Diocletian certainly saw an end to it. Diocletian left Nicomedia not long after. However, before his departure, he unleashed his fury upon the Christians of his capital, and a general pogrom began, which continued into the following weeks. Christians were ordered to be butchered in wholesale heaps, some by the sword, others by fire, and still others by drowning, where the public executioners bound them in boats for all to witness before casting them into the depths. Some Christians even took the opportunity to gain the crown of martyrdom by casting themselves upon the flaming pyres. Even martyred imperial servants already buried were dug up and cast into the sea to prevent their relics from being venerated. The Antiochian presbyter and biblical scholar Lucian was arrested at this time, alongside Anthemus, the bishop of Nicomedia, and five of the bishop's companions. Lucian remained in prison, but Anthemus and his companions were beheaded on April 24th. Lucian wrote to his fellow Antiochians from prison, describing how the bishop had attained the crown of martyrdom. 4 days later, two presbyters named Eusebius and Haralambus, as well as 268 other Christians, were slaughtered in a single day. Another prominent Christian named Donatus, a friend of Lactantius, was imprisoned and tortured by the fanatically anti-Christian governor, Socinus Hierocles, whom we discussed last episode. Like Lucian, Donatus remained imprisoned and continued to suffer under Hierocles' successor, Priscillianus, 3 years later. Such were the opening events at Nicomedia, events which take us all the way back to the first persecution of Christians under Nero in Rome, when Christians had also been scapegoated for a great fire in a capital city. While the pogrom in Nicomedia raged, Diocletian's edict was reaching the provinces. For this episode, we're going to stay focused on the first years of the persecution in the East. We'll cover events in the West next episode. Just so you're all aware, I plan to keep using this format of alternating between East and West for the next few episodes. When it comes to our sources for the Great Persecution, Eusebius and Lactantius are our main guides. In addition to the church history, Eusebius also wrote in great detail about specific friends and acquaintances who were martyred in his home province in his book, The Martyrs of Palestine. His account is detailed but selective. He does not dwell on apostates who lapsed under persecution, and focuses on individual persons he was familiar with. His account is by no means intended to be an exhaustive catalog of every single Christian who suffered martyrdom in the Holy Land during the Great Persecution. Nevertheless, Eusebius's account is irreplaceably valuable. Unfortunately, no other Christian writer composed a general account of the persecution in their home province like Eusebius. Lactantius's account, entitled On the Deaths of the Persecutors, focuses instead on the political history of the Roman Empire to describe how each of the persecuting emperors met their end. Thus, for the rest of the empire, we are largely left with the mixed bag that is the Acts of the early Christian martyrs. As before, when we covered prior persecutions, all the usual caveats apply when using the Acts of the Martyrs as historical sources. A precious tiny few survive, which are either not altered or mostly not altered, by later legendary additions. Many martyrs whose stories only survive in legend probably did exist as historical persons because their veneration is attested to early on, but nothing much can be said about them. Our goal in this podcast is to focus on those sources which provide us reliable information as opposed to later legend. Christians in Palestine were preparing to celebrate Easter when the governor Flavianus posted Diocletian's first edict in late March or early April. As Eusebius resided in the provincial capital of Caesarea, he saw firsthand as recalcitrant Christians were sent to the governor's court. The governor was the only local magistrate in a province with the authority to use capital punishment. The first martyr of Palestine Eusebius informs us about is Procopius of Scythopolis. A native of Jerusalem, Procopius was a reader, exorcist, and Syriac interpreter in the church of Scythopolis. He was devoted to an ascetical life of fasting and prayer. After failure to comply with the first edict, Procopius and his companions were sent to Caesarea. As soon as they appeared before the governor, Flavianus urged Procopius to sacrifice to the gods. Procopius replied that there was only one God, the creator of the universe. Flavianus found nothing objectionable about this statement, perhaps akin to the philosophical monotheism of pagans like Celsus and Porphyry. So he instead ordered Procopius to sacrifice to the four emperors. Procopius retorted by quoting the Iliad, stating, "The lordship of many is not a good thing. Let there be one ruler, one king." This remark was immediately interpreted by the governor as a treasonous utterance against the Tetrarchy, and so Procopius was beheaded on June 7, 303. Eusebius does not describe what happened to Procopius's companions, but they either gave in and sacrificed, or, more likely, were emboldened by Procopius's example, and so also attained the crown of martyrdom. Shortly afterwards, the second of Diocletian's sanguinary edicts was posted in Palestine. It commanded that all Christian clergy be imprisoned. This measure was similar to Valerian's persecution. Diocletian was targeting the church's leadership with the goal of breaking them, and in so doing, break the rank-and-file believers. The edict was issued in response to uprisings against the empire, which occurred in the city of Melitene, in the easternmost province of Armenia Minor, and in the province of Syria. These uprisings appear to have occurred in the spring and summer of that year. On May 3rd, two Christians from the city of Melitene named Hermogenes and Halpidius were martyred. Persecution in Armenia Minor continued under the first edict. A couple months later, the Christian-born Athenogenes, the bishop of Pedicto, received the martyr's crown on July 17th in the city of Sebaste, under the governor Agricola. Eusebius records that the spectacle which followed Diocletian's second edict surpassed description. Bishops, presbyters, deacons, readers, and exorcists all across the Eastern Empire were arrested and locked up. The prisons became overcrowded, and the authorities were forced to release actual criminals in order to make room for the Christian clergy. The situation was not sustainable for the imperial authorities. Thus, soon after, as part of general demonstrations of his imperial clemency, Diocletian issued his third edict in honor of his approaching Vicennalia celebration, the 20th anniversary year of his accession. Any imprisoned Christian clergy would be immediately released if they offered sacrifice. Authorities were directed to make the Christian leadership sacrifice by any means necessary, which obviously meant coercion and torture, but it also had other results. Many Christian clergy succumbed, and to the shame of their congregations, gave in and offered sacrifice. But many also held firm under the artifices devised against them. Christian clergy were lashed, flogged, and stretched on the rack. Some even lost the use of their hands. The Roman authorities, for their part, were often more interested in just making the victims appear to comply with the edict. Some clergy were seized on all sides and had their arms and hands manipulated so that they just dropped a sacrifice onto an altar. Others were simply recorded to have sacrificed when they actually hadn't. In these situations, some church leaders left the matter alone, while others loudly insisted publicly that they had never sacrificed. In these cases, such men were often rebuked and told to just be silent by the authorities. Eusebius notes one such clergyman who, after making his protest, was struck on the mouth and silenced before being escorted away. Another man was so worn down by imprisonment and torture that he looked half dead, and so was released from prison and counted as having sacrificed, when he actually hadn't. In the enforcement of the Third Edict, we see that not all Roman administrators were enthusiastic persecutors like Galerius or Hierocles. Many just wanted to be able to report that they had done their job in enforcing the emperor's law and punch out for the day. Such was not the case in Egypt, where in the north, the province of Egypt was governed by the prefect Clodius Colchianus, and in the south, the Thebaid province was governed by Satrius Arianus. Both men rigorously enforced Diocletian's legislation and would be remembered with infamy long after their time by the Coptic or native Egyptian Christians. Peter, the bishop of Alexandria, went into hiding probably not long after the second edict was published. Exactly where the Coptic pope went is uncertain, but some sources point toward Mesopotamia. Like Cyprian and Dionysius before him, Peter continued to run the church while in exile. His decision to flee was, in part, motivated by a desire to prevent further violence from erupting against the Christians of his city, a quite sensible justification given all the riots and mob violence we've seen in previous persecutions of the Church of Alexandria. However, also like Cyprian and Dionysius, Peter would have to deal with accusations of cowardice, and eventually, schism. These events we will explore further two episodes from now. In order to still run the church, Peter appointed traveling laymen and lower-ranking clergy to act like bishops with regards to communication between parishes. These laymen were not given sacramental authority, nor were the presbyters elevated to bishops. Normal church functions would have to wait until the persecution ended, or at least entered a lull. These traveling appointees were a reminder to the Christians of Egypt that their pope still cared for them and was still striving to look after his flock. While the pope was in exile, many other Alexandrian and Coptic clergy were being targeted by the persecution. One particular case was that of Apollonius, bishop of Lycopolis, down in Upper Egypt. Apollonius appears to have acted rashly and confronted the imperial authorities directly with enthusiasm. Thus, we still see the same two divergent attitudes towards martyrdom. Those, like Peter, who argued it was not something to be sought after, but accepted if death came, and those who wanted to aggressively court death by actively seeking out martyrdom. However, unlike his other zealous contemporaries, Apollonius appears to have given in and sacrificed. Such a betrayal seriously hurt the church in the Thebaid province. Apollonius was not even the only one. Other Coptic bishops had sacrificed and yet still clung to their episcopal offices, even though their spiritual and moral authority was utterly compromised. Peter wrote a letter to Apollonius excoriating him for both his apostasy and for the damage he had done to the faith of the Christians in his area. This was exactly why the Bishop of Alexandria disapproved of Christians actively trying to provoke their own martyrdom. Not all Christian clergy in Egypt were like Apollonius, however, and many remained loyal to Peter's instruction, neither seeking out martyrdom nor succumbing when the time came. Back in Palestine, Eusebius records two martyrs in connection with the Third Edict. As the Vicennalia festival of 303 was approaching, numerous criminals were granted clemency and released from prisons. The clergy, of course, would only be let go if they sacrificed. A beloved deacon in the church of Gadara named Zacchaeus was dragged in an iron collar before the governor. After refusing to sacrifice, he was handed over to be tortured by having his skin scraped. After these torments, he was stretched in the stocks all day and all night. At the same time, a reader and exorcist in the church of Caesarea named Alpheus was haled before Flavianus. Alpheus was from a well-to-do family in his hometown of Eleutheriopolis, and was renowned as a great preacher and teacher of the scriptures in Caesarea. When he saw numerous Christians giving in due to fear and preparing to apostatize, he threw himself into the crowd of torturers and boldly reminded his brethren that Christ had said that those who deny him before men, he will deny before his Father. Alpheus was then immediately arrested. Being filled with the Spirit of God, as Eusebius says, Alpheus gave a bold apology before the governor. After which, Flavianus subjected him to scrapings, and when this failed, Alpheus was also in prison and stretched in the stocks. After 3 days, both Zacchaeus and Alpheus were brought before the governor on November 17, 303, who offered them one final opportunity to sacrifice to the divine genius of the emperors. Both men declared they knew no king but God himself, and so Flavianus had them beheaded. Eusebius also reports that the deacon Romanus attained the crown of martyrdom in Antioch on the same day. Romanus was the Caesarean deacon we mentioned last episode, who had interrupted the sacrifices at Diocletian's court. Some copies of Eusebius' account state that, despite Romanus' tongue being removed, the martyr was still able to miraculously speak. After enduring torture in the stocks, Romanus was finally strangled to death. So closes Eusebius' account of Palestine for 303. In addition to being the year which was supposed to mark the beginning of the end of Christianity, 303 was also set to be a celebration of the Tetrarchy's achievements in restoring the Roman world. Diocletian planned a full-blown political extravaganza in the Roman city he had for so long neglected to visit, Rome itself. All four emperors would travel together to the Eternal City for a shared triumph over the Persians, parading the harem of the Sassanid king Narses through the streets, and presenting the victory as the shared accomplishment of the entire imperial college. It would also mark the beginning of the Vicennalia celebration of both Augusti. Maximian's regnal years were artificially adjusted to make his Vicennalia coincide with Diocletian's. 303 would also mark the Decennalia, or 10-year anniversary, of the ascension of the Caesars, Constantius, and Galerius. Although we can't be certain, it seems that in the autumn of that year, the four emperors met in northern Italy before proceeding on to Rome, probably in the city of Milan, where they discussed the future and succession plans. We will return to this event in a couple episodes. It seems Galerius, however, was forced to the Danube due to some military emergency, likely an invasion of Carpi or Sarmatian tribes. By mid-November, the remaining three emperors made their triumphal entry into the Eternal City. Diocletian presided over public spectacles and games, dispensing imperial largesse and clemency to celebrate the beginning of his Vicennalia on November 20th. In the end, though, the emperor did not enjoy his stay in Rome. Long accustomed to his servile court prostrating themselves before him as their dominus, the Romans of Rome still held to their quasi-republican sensibilities. They regarded the imperial office in accordance with the old principate model, the emperor as first citizen. The frank way the inhabitants of the old capital treated the emperor astounded Diocletian, who had for so long been venerated as Jupiter's representative on earth. On top of this was the public debauchery, licentiousness, hysteria, and ecstasy which accompanied the public games and festival. All this made for an image which contrasted sharply with Diocletian's image of the pious and civically virtuous Romans of old, whom he had sought to emulate. The mutual hostility between the Illyrian emperor and the citizens caused the Augustus to end his stay early, and he departed the city on December 20th to head north for the coastal city of Ravenna. There, on the 1st of January, he assumed his 9th consulship. However, the winter journey was not easy, and the emperor contracted an illness while en route. At first, the illness was mild, but it quickly grew in strength. So much so that Diocletian's entourage did not return to Nicomedia until around August. It appears the illness sapped the aging emperor of both his energy and his gravitas within the Imperial College. Thus far, the edicts of persecution were intended to prevent general bloodshed where possible. Now, though, imperial policy changed for the worse. In January or February 304, Diocletian issued his final and harshest edict to the eastern provinces. All subjects were to offer sacrifice and libations to the gods, or be tortured and put to death. It was the demand for universal sacrifice once enacted by Decius over 50 years earlier, and the policy which Galerius, Hierocles, and Porphyry had advocated for. In his biography of Diocletian, suggests that the senior emperor was no longer in complete control of the government, for so greatly had his sickness weakened him physically, mentally, and politically. The Caesar Galerius was perhaps now the one really directing things at court, and in the early months of 304, he finally got Diocletian to issue the decree he had so long desired. Galerius and his cronies could really come off the leash now, and stamp out the Christian superstition once and for all. Unshackled by the Fourth Edict, this new phase in the persecution was marked by an incredible increase in savage brutality. Christians of all statuses were compelled by every means to sacrifice to the gods. If the Christians still refused, then it would be they who were offered up, as it were. Christians would sacrifice, either as offerers or as victims. The gods would be satisfied one way or another. In the province of Phrygia, an entire town was completely destroyed by Roman soldiers because every single one of its citizens and magistrates were Christians. Another Christian from Phrygia named Aduactus, who had served in the imperial government as a finance minister, also attained the crown of martyrdom. In Pontus, the violence used by officials began with driving reeds underneath the fingernails of Christians, before escalating to more severe methods, such as pouring molten lead on the martyr's naked back. Torture became something of a contest among the officials, but eventually this began to have a debilitating effect on the local cities, and so the government decided to maim Christians and gouge out their eyes instead. In Cappadocia, Christians had their legs broken. In Roman Mesopotamia, Christians were hung upside down over smoking fires to suffocate them to death. In the city of Antioch, Christians were slowly roasted alive over grills. Some decided to plunge their hands into the fire to avoid sacrificing, while others offered themselves to their persecutors by leaping from the top of buildings. A particularly chilling story is that of the Christian matron, Domnina of Antioch, and her two daughters. The three women fled Antioch to the city of Edessa, but were discovered by the pagan men of their family and arrested. On the way back, when it became clear that the authorities were planning to use sexual violence to force the Christian women to apostatize, Domnina and her two daughters persuaded the soldiers to give them a moment of privacy by the riverbank, after which all three of them drowned themselves in order to avoid being raped. In Phoenicia and Arabia, Christians were beheaded. In Alexandria, Christians had their different body parts cut off. In Egypt, Eusebius describes how Christian men, women, and children were killed. If their bodies survived being scraped, stretched, and whipped, they were finally burned alive. Others were drowned or were nailed down to stakes and starved to death. The more fortunate ones were beheaded. Galerius and his ilk were now unleashed. Despite his prominent role in the persecution, however, we have scanty information about the persecution in the territories Galerius directly governed, the Balkans and Thrace. There are a handful of martyrdom accounts dealing with the Christians of Pannonia, Moesia, and Thrace, but these records in their current form are highly suspect. One prominent martyr we do know the name of is Victorinus, the bishop of Poetovio in Pannonia, who wrote a commentary on the Book of Revelation, which we discussed just prior to the narrative break. Though we don't possess a literary account, we do know the day Victorinus achieved the crown of martyrdom was November 2nd, likely either in 303 or 304 AD. We do have one precious authentic martyrdom account which does survive from the domains of Galerius. During the first year of the persecution, a group of seven young Christian women fled the city of Thessalonica to a nearby mountain. In so doing, most of them had to renounce the authority of their pagan families, who would have turned them in. Three were sisters named Agape, Chione, Irene, and the others were named Agatho, Cassia, Philippa, and Eutychia. The last woman was a recent widow who was pregnant with her deceased Christian husband's child. In late March 304, not long after the fourth edict reached Macedonia, the women were discovered and brought before the tribunal of the governor, Dulcidius. Dulcidius asked each of them why they refused to comply with the imperial edict and offered them a chance to obey the law and sacrifice. When he noticed Eutychia was pregnant, he made sneering comments about how, if her husband was dead, she could be pregnant. Eutychia's husband had died 7 months earlier. Agape and Chione, the eldest of the group, were sentenced to be burned alive, while Eutychia was imprisoned due to her pregnancy, and the other three women were imprisoned because of their youth. These sentences were carried out immediately, and so Agape and Chione attained the martyr's crown. The following day, their sister Irene was once again brought before the governor. She had been discovered to be in possession of Christian books, in defiance of Diocletian's first edict. Infuriated by the girl's righteous obstinacy, Dulcidius devised a disturbing punishment. Irene was sent naked to a local brothel frequented by the soldiers. However, by divine protection it seems, none of the men dared to lay a hand on her. Defeated, Dulcidius called her back and offered her one final chance to abandon her faith. When she refused, the governor sentenced her to death, and on April 1st, 304, Irene was burned alive at the same spot where her two sisters had earned their martyrdom. Returning to Eusebius' account of Palestine, by the spring of 304, the governor Flavianus had been succeeded by a man named Urbanus. Urbanus would remain in office for the next 4 years and quickly showed himself to be an enthusiastic persecutor. A Christian in the coastal city of Gaza named Timothy was attacked by the local pagans for defying the command to sacrifice, and afterwards delivered to the new provincial governor. Urbanus subjected Timothy to scourgings and lacerations, until finally he had the steadfast martyr slowly burned alive on the 21st of May. On that same day, another group of Christians from Gaza were also tried by Urbanus. Two of them are named by Eusebius as Agapius and Thecla. Interestingly, Thecla was a Montanist Christian, as were her companions. Her inclusion in Eusebius' narrative perhaps suggests that during the persecution, some Christian groups put aside their differences and stood together. The governor decided to keep all of them in prison so they could later be used as food for the wild beasts during the upcoming celebrations for the end of the emperor's Vicennalia year. When the day came on November 20th, 304, a group of six Christians learned that their brethren were about to be condemned to the beasts in the arena. Their names were Timoleus of Pontus, Dionysius of Tripoli, Romulus, a subdeacon in the church of Diospolis, two Egyptians, one named Paisus and the other Alexander, and another Christian named Alexander, also from the city of Gaza. They accosted the governor as he was heading to the arena to expose Agapius and Thecla to the wild beasts. They declared their willingness to suffer and die alongside their brethren in the games. The stunned Urbanus had them all imprisoned and proceeded to see Thecla martyred in the arena. Agapius of Gaza managed to survive the ordeal and was sent back to the prison. On the same day Thecla and Agapius were being exposed to wild beasts in Palestine, the ailing Diocletian was completing the celebration of his Vicennalia year in Nicomedia. In the preceding months, the emperor's health had declined precipitously. After dedicating a new circus in his capital, the senior Augustus collapsed. The following month, the emperor completely disappeared from public view, confined to his putative deathbed in the imperial palace. Soon, rumors of his death began to swirl throughout the city. We'll leave Diocletian and the Eastern churches there for now. Next episode, we'll cover the persecution in the West and see how Maximian and Constantius enforced Diocletian's anti-Christian policy. As we shall see, cracks within the Tetrarchy would begin to manifest in the divergent enforcement of the persecution between East and West. As always, thank you for listening. If you have questions or feedback about the podcast, you can email me at historyoftheearlychurch@gmail.com. Please don't forget to leave a review on iTunes or whatever podcast platform you use. Post a comment on the Facebook page, facebook.com/earlychurchpodcast. And don't forget to visit the website at historyoftheearlychurch.wordpress.com.